from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up with primary elections in seven states now behind us and more next week, are there any trends developing? What messages are motivating voters? We'll talk about it with founder and CEO of Ballotpedia, Scott Rasmussen. That's coming up in just a moment. And the fate of Pensacola's Bayview Park Cross now rests with three federal judges after oral arguments were held yesterday. Luke Goodrich, attorney with Beckett Fund Law Firm, will be here with the latest on this important case. Also, more and more states are addressing the scourge of pornography. Missouri may be the next state to declare pornography a health crisis. Missouri State Senator Ed Emery will be here to talk about that. And the totalitarian tactics of the left are on the march in California. The director of FRC Center for Religious Liberty, Travis Weber, and our senior fellow for policy studies, Peter Sprigg, will be here to explain the dangers of Assembly Bill 2943. You won't want to miss that. That's coming up on this edition of Washington Watch. If you happen to miss anything on your way home this afternoon, you can find it all later archived at TonyPerkins.com. In fact, we've had some great programs this week. If you missed any of them, they're all archived at TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me at T. Perkins. Okay. Another series of battles for Congress happened this past Tuesday in primary races in four states, Pennsylvania, Nebraska, Oregon, and Idaho. Now, that's the second wave. We've had seven states in totality that have had primaries and a lot more to come. But are we seeing any trends emerge? Are there messages that are connecting with voters on both sides of the aisle? Well, with us now, Scott Rasmussen. He is the founder and CEO of Ballotpedia. Scott, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's always great to be with you.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to be talking a lot over the next several months as these races take place. Okay, is it still too early to see any trends? Are we seeing any trends emerge?
Well, we're certainly seeing a number of trends emerge. One thing on the Democratic side we are seeing is it is clearly the year of the woman for Democrats. In open seat primaries where women are competing, they are winning most of the time. And on the Republican side, something we talked about last week, it is turning out to be a difficult year for Republican members of Congress. Raul Labrador, founding member of the Freedom Caucus, was expected to win the Idaho governor's primary, but that didn't work out. It just seems there's a lot of frustration with the Republican House. But when you look beyond those themes and try and get a sense for where things are heading and what we might see towards November, there is a clear sign that there is a civil war among the Democrats that is breaking out, and it's good news for the Republicans.
Civil war in terms of ideology. I mean, you've got a more moderate Democratic vision competing with a more liberal, progressive Bernie Sanders vision.
Absolutely, and we've heard a lot all this year about how the enthusiasm of the progressive base, the people that are just furious and can't believe Donald Trump is president, that's going to fuel this tremendous turnout for the Democrats. And to be clear, it has. Democratic turnout has been very good, and I'm expected to be very good in November. But it's a double-edged sword. So in Nebraska's 2nd District, expected to be a very competitive race. Don Bacon is the incumbent Republican. Brad Ashford was the man he defeated 2 years ago and was in Congress before that. The Democratic national strategist expected Ashford to win. He's a very moderate Democrat, one of the most conservative Democrats in the House when he was there. But he was upset by Kara Eastman. And again, keeping in mind this is Nebraska, Eastman, a social worker, was campaigning on a $15 minimum wage, on Medicare for All, a very strong progressive platform, and it did carry her to victory. All of a sudden, though, that's a situation. She just doesn't match the district. She is too far left for that district. In my sense, that went from a toss-up to now clearly favoring Don Bacon in Nebraska, too. In Pennsylvania's 1st District, We talked a lot about Pennsylvania earlier in the year because of all the court-ordered redistricting that went on.
Right.
Pennsylvania's first district under the old map had voted heavily for Donald Trump, and now it's a slightly Clinton-leaning district, expecting a very close race. The woman running for the Democratic nomination there was Rachel Reddick. She was a Navy veteran, a former Republican, could have been a really good fit for the Bucks County District. But Scott Wallace put in $2.5 million of his own money. He's very progressive, pretty easy to caricature as elite and out of touch. And by the way, he even has a famous grandfather, Henry Wallace, who was a very progressive Democratic vice president under FDR. So Wallace won that race. The more that we see these progressive Democrats winning nominations in toss-up districts, the better the Republican prospects for hanging on to control.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I think, you know, that does become more of a challenge in the general election. However, how does that affect turnout? I mean, if you've got someone who is, you know, really clearly defined on a set of issues, they tend to be more, it tends to motivate a base vote more. I mean, we saw this with Barack Obama in many ways. So will this then turn out to be really a competitive turnout your base election?
It is going to be a turnout and base oriented election. And people that have a clear message that can connect will do very well. You know, if you're Elizabeth Warren and you're running in Massachusetts on a very clearly articulated progressive platform, well, you're going to do just fine. But if you are running in a, as Kara Eastman will now be doing, in a somewhat conservative state like Nebraska, in a district like Nebraska too, that same message doesn't work as well. It's out of touch with that electorate. I think what there's a couple of things that we're seeing on this. The Democrats, we have known all along, because they have a clear message, because it is a resistance to President Trump, they are going to have good turnout. We've seen it in all of the primaries. However, some of the messaging from the Democrats will turn off the swing voters, not very many of them. But the people who are kind of on the fence as to whether they're going to show up and vote. So if you are a Republican or an independent who disapproves of President Trump, but you still think he was the lesser of two evils, you're not going to be really excited about a Democrat who is talking about impeaching the president, or a Democrat who is talking about moving the party forward to the left, or even, as Nancy Pelosi said, a Democrat who will, you know, raise taxes on the middle class. This is a these voters can be turned off. On the Republican side, the question has been, can the Trump voters, can those people who showed up and delivered a stunning upset in 2016 retain the energy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer to that so far appears to be yes. Republican turnout in the primaries has generally been pretty good. We're finding consistently in every opportunity where there is a choice between coming with a more centrist, old school message or being a supporter of Donald Trump. Donald Trump supporters are winning these primaries, and every candidate in the Republican primaries is trying to build upon that support.
Yeah, we talked about that in Ohio being the case. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Scott Rasmussen, my guest. I'm going to jump back to the 30,000-foot view from a national perspective. I know we're looking at these particular districts, and that's important because that's what's going to decide the control of Congress. But it looks like nationally the Democrats are losing ground as well in the generic congressional polls. They went from a pretty wide margin this winter to down to, I think, an ABC Washington Post poll this early this week showed just a four-point margin of being ahead of the Republicans. So something's happening out there where they're losing the traction, even though, as you point out, there's a lot of discontent with Congress. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to move to Democrats to control Congress.
That's correct. In fact, I write a weekly column for the Creator Syndicate. And my column today begins by noting that last December, Democrats had a 13-point advantage on the generic ballot, and there was great talk of this big blue wave, and it wasn't a question of would Democrats win control. It was, will their, you know, midterm success be as big as the Republicans were, the Republican success was back in 2010. Now, on the Real Clear Politics average, the generic ballot is down to a Democratic lead of about 5 points. And at that level, you expect the Democrats will gain some seats this year, but it's far from clear they can win enough to win control. It becomes a toss-up. That's why we start talking about these individual races. What happened? Well, right after that 13-point lead was registered for the Democrats, Republicans did pass a tax cut. And as part of that, they eliminated the Obamacare mandate. That began to energize the Republican base, give them a sense there was some reason to turn out. On top of that, there have been continuing efforts to reduce the regulatory burden on the economy. And all of this has resulted in people feeling better about the country than they have in a long time, and the economy is doing very well. Those things are moving the Republicans, are moving people in a direction to be more favorably disposed towards the Republican Party. The Democrats seem to be catching up a little bit to this message, and for a very long time, we're simply sticking to the same old story of we're going to repeal the tax cuts, we're going to do some other traditionally progressive things, and that just isn't connecting. So now, I think the Republicans, look, there's still 6 months to go.
Right, right.
You and I both know a lot can happen in the political world.
Yeah.
The things that we know are likely to happen, if the economy continues to do well and if the if there's no major shocks, I think the Republicans have a very good shot at retaining control. Still underdogs, but a decent shot. And beyond that, it depends on what the parties do.
Scott, one final note for I let you go. The when you look at those conservatives, you said a lot of folks running, associating themselves with Trump. Those are the ones that are doing well thus far.
Yep.
Are there some particular themes? You know, I've seen some of the information I've seen to show that the social issues are ranking up there toward the top, along with the economic issues. Is there going to be, are there going to be some overriding issues, themes that we see throughout this campaign?
The economy is always a very important issue. The social issues in particular will get reflected in Senate races because that will come back to a lot of questions about Supreme Court nominees. And I will be stunned if we don't hear a tremendous amount of talk about Supreme Court and other court appointments in key Senate races around the country. Immigration and attitudes towards immigration and attitudes towards citizenship in general will be an important underlying theme in all of this. And again, we're talking about this in a theoretical state.
Right.
Things with North Korea could surprise us. Something else may pop up.
You never can tell. Never can tell. Scott, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. As always, great to talk with you.
Look forward to talking again. Have a great day.
All right. Well, we will be talking again. Trust me. Scott Rasmussen, Ballotpedia. All right. We'll be covering that a lot in the next several months. All right, coming up next, the cross. Arguments yesterday before a federal circuit court. What will be the outcome? We'll talk about it next with a Beckett Fund attorney. Don't go away.
Are you a pastor? Do you know a pastor? We want to invite pastors to Family Research Council's Watchmen on the Wall Pastors Briefing on May 23rd through 25th in Washington, D.C. The theme this year is While It Is Day, Repent, Unite, Engage. Pastors will hear from John Bevere, Michelle Bachman, Josh McDowell, Kay Arthur, Todd Starnes, congressional leaders, and others who will inform, inspire, and equip them to engage on issues relevant to today's culture. They will also enjoy a tour and reception at Museum of the Bible, a spiritual heritage tour of the U.S. Capitol, and networking with other pastors from around the nation. Registration is just $249 for first-time pastors and $299 for pastors who have attended before. FRC has limited funding to cover hotels and meal costs. For more information and to register, call 1-800-225-4008 or visit watchmanpastors.org. That's 1-800-225-4008 or watchmanpastors.org.
Have you ever wondered how your cell phone company is spending your hard-earned money? For years, big money has flowed from big mobile carriers to liberals fighting to fund organizations like Planned Parenthood. With Patriot Mobile, your money will only be used to support conservative organizations like Family Research Council Action. Patriot Mobile is offering unlimited talk, text, and data at better prices than anything you can get from Big Mobile. More importantly, up to 5% of your monthly bill goes specifically to support conservative causes at no additional cost to you. You get the same nationwide coverage with unlimited talk, text, and data for a better price. Right now, unlimited talk and text starts at $20 a month. And as an exclusive FRC Action offer, get a free $50 credit with a 24-month contract when you use promo code FRCA18. To switch, call 1-800-A-PATRIOT or visit patriotmobile.com. You have probably heard a lot about the LGBT movement on television, in social media, in the news, and from celebrities. But do you know what is true and what is not true? FRC has created a new resource that gives you the facts on LGBT issues to help you navigate challenging topics in human sexuality. To get factual, practical answers on how to respond to the LGBT movement, go to frc.org/LGBT.
Since the 2016 election, faith, family, and freedom are on the move in America. Can values voters keep the momentum going in November? If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand with our leaders and fight for our values. To join this noble mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 21st to 23rd in Washington, D.C. Past speakers include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Paul Ryan, Kirk Cameron, Dana Loesch, and Ben Carson. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, by the way, I didn't mention it in our last segment, but obviously you need to be registered in voting, even in these primaries. It's important. It's part of your Christian duty. Okay, speaking of there's a 34-foot Christian cross at a public park in Pensacola, Florida. We've talked about this before. It's been the subject of a number of lawsuits. Well, yesterday in the federal appeals court, oral arguments were made on behalf of this. It's the latest in this round of legal battles over the constitutionality of a religious landmark that stood there for almost 80 years. Now, the attorney who argued this is with the Beckett Fund, Luke Goodrich, and he joins us now by phone. He is the vice president and senior counsel with Beckett. Luke, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Tony. Great to be here.
All right. Yesterday, oral arguments. How did things go yesterday before the circuit court?
Arguments yesterday went very well. We're optimistic that we'll get a good ruling from the circuit court. And this is a particularly powerful case because, as you mentioned, this cross has been in a park for over 77 years now. It was put up right as our nation was on the verge of World War II, and it was a time when the citizens of Pensacola really came together to pray for the country and to come together as a community. And so the city of Pensacola wants to keep that part of its history and culture alive.
Yeah, in fact, he might be listening now. My former first sergeant when I was in the Marine Corps lives in Pensacola now. He's been retired for a number of years, but the last time I talked to him, he was talking to me about this case because he sees the cross there in the bay. And, you know, this is really an affront to all of those who have defended freedom in this country to see displays just because it has a religious nature to be taken down.
That's right. The Pensacola JCs, a community service organization, was the ones that put up this cross. And each year they would have services there. They would gather flowers to bring to the military hospitals. And people would bring flowers in remembrance of those who had died serving the country. And it's really been a part of bringing the citizens of Pensacola together. And the city simply wants to allow that memory to flourish.
So, Luke, what are the arguments against the cross? What were the arguments being made that says this has to be torn down?
So the case is brought by four atheists Two of them live in Canada and have nothing to do with the cross.
The cross isn't that big. You can't see it from that far north, can you?
It's not that big, that's for sure. But they still say they're offended all the way from our neighbors in the north. One of the other plaintiffs lives outside Pensacola but has come into the city to view the cross and be offended. And the fourth plaintiff is actually a Satanist who reserved the cross on one Easter morning. He actually kicked out a church that was planning to have a Easter service there, and he used the cross for his own, what he called, satanic rituals. And it's these four individuals who have sued the city of Pensacola. They say the cross is offensive to them and violates the separation of church and state and has to be taken down.
What's interesting on the other side of this, Luke, as Beckett Fund represents the city in the interest of the cross down there, that you have a groundswell of support from different states. I mean, you've even got Jewish groups and various associations of attorneys defending the right to have the cross there.
That's exactly right, because the core question at the center of this case is, what is the government's posture toward religion supposed to be? Can the government view religion as a basic part of our history and culture and recognize the role that religion has played in American life? Or does the government have to be hostile toward religion and cordon it off, you know, erase it from the public square and erase it even if it's a fundamental part of our history and culture? And there are a lot of groups, everything from municipal lawyers, like you mentioned, to Jewish groups, to states, and to many others who say, hey, we don't want the government to be hostile toward religion. We want the government to be able to recognize that religion is a fundamental part of human culture.
Stepping aside from just this one particular case that you argued yesterday, isn't that what we're seeing, though, in the string of decisions we've seen in recent years, kind of a hostility toward religious expression?
There's certainly a current of that you can see in a lot of cases. But at Beckett, we've also won a lot of these cases. And
True. We
think we are winning the battle. And especially the U.S. Supreme Court, there are five justices who recently voted in the Town of Greece case involving legislative prayer.
Right.
And they voted to say, hey, we need to get back to what the Constitution meant historically. And the Constitution doesn't mean the government should be hostile toward religion. The Constitution has always meant that the government can recognize the role religion plays in our culture. So we're very optimistic that we can win this case and that in the long run, we will get a decision from the Supreme Court that says government can recognize the important role religion plays in human life.
Do you think this case will go all the way to the Supreme Court?
There's a great chance that it will. There are a couple cases like this one. There's one in Maryland involving the Bladensburg Cross.
Correct,
it was put up
right
over 90 years ago to memorialize World War I veterans. And both of these cases have a great shot at going to the U.S. Supreme Court. It'll depend on how the courts of appeals rule and which one the Supreme Court thinks is best.
Well, Luke Goodrich, thank you for joining us today, and thanks for the excellent work that the Beckett Fund does on so many of these religious freedom cases.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. And if listeners want to find out more about the case, you can go to beckettlaw.org.
All right. We'll have a link to that as well. Luke, thanks so much. Folks, this underscores why the courts are so important. We see all these nomination debates that are taking place even right now in the United States Senate. This is what it's about, especially at the circuit court levels. And by the way, I think we talked about this earlier in the week, but the administration is on track to set a record with the number of circuit court justices that have been confirmed. I think we're up to like 1/8 or so. I don't want to say the number because I forget it. I might get it wrong. But a large number of circuit court justices now have been approved during the Trump administration. So these things are very important because these are the fundamental freedoms that are at stake. All right, don't go away. When we come back, we're going to go to Missouri, where the state of Missouri is poised to be the latest state to recognize the health crisis created by pornography. That's next when we talk to Senator Ed Emery. Don't go away. We're back after this.
Thank you. Hello, can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice.
You have probably heard a lot about the LGBT movement on television and social media, in the news, and from celebrities. But do you know what is true and what is not true? FRC has created a new resource that gives you the facts on LGBT issues to help you navigate challenging topics in human sexuality. To get factual, practical answers on how to respond to the LGBT movement, go to frc.org/LGBT. For years, big money has flowed from big mobile carriers to liberals fighting to fund organizations like Planned Parenthood. With Patriot Mobile, a portion of your bill will be used to support conservative organizations like Family Research Council Action. And as an exclusive FRC Action offer, get a free $50 credit with a 24-month contract when you use promo code FRCA18. Call now 1-800-A-PATRIOT or visit patriotmobile.com. If you think anti-Semitism is a thing of the past, think again. In the last 3 years, over 1,700 anti-Semitic incidents have occurred on college campuses across the country. This new anti-Semitism is disguised simply as opposition to the State of Israel's policies toward Palestinians. But a closer look at these incidents reveal how Jewish college students are being attacked merely for believing that Israel should exist. For more information on this important issue, visit frc.org/antisemitism.
You are listening to Washington Watch, and I am your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me, at T. Perkins. Okay, growing recognition by the states of really a public health crisis that's being created by pornography. Utah being one of the first states a couple of years ago to take that move. A lot of criticism, for the governor when he signed it, people making fun of it. But the studies are now backing this up, and we're up to almost 10 states that have adopted this. It was actually part of the GOP platform 2 summers ago that was put in there to bring recognition to the problems created with pornography. Well, Missouri is poised to be the next state. They have the Senate there has adopted a resolution that declares pornography a public health threat. And it's designed to combat pornography and to educate the citizens, and particularly young people, about the harms that come from it and how addictive it is. With us now is the author of the resolution, Missouri State Senator Ed Emery. Ed, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be with you.
Now, Senator, tell our listeners what kind of motivated you to take on this issue.
You know, that's an interesting story. A young man who has made this kind of his life work, for the time being at least, approached my staff and I and explained the work that he was doing across the country and what his vision was for how he could try to address this and try to arrest it in some fashion, and explained to us what the process had been in other states, and it sounded like something that Missouri should be involved with. I mean, I think no one can deny the seriousness of the problem. We don't all have all the details and all the studies and all the work that's been done to validate the problem, but most of us, either in our own experience or in the experience of friends, have seen it and recognized it and the addictiveness of pornography.
You know, Senator, I think it's a very important point to bring, because, you know, most of us, actually statistically would say that there are a lot of people that have a problem with pornography. But, you know, you don't talk about it. You don't see it on the news. You don't see the stories. And when people are involved in it, they become kind of isolated, and they know it's a problem, but they don't know how broad the problem really is. As you looked into this, was any of this shocking to you to see how widespread it was and how pernicious the pornography material was in the lives of people?
It is. I mean, it's. I was aware of the problem, and I even have friends who are engaged in trying to address some of these problems in their churches. But the way that it has spread across the country, and of course now is infecting the young people who are then carrying those addictions all the way into adulthood. I think that's the shocking part, is when you realize that it is, it's just everywhere around us, and it's not something that people talk about, because
right.
most people have enough of a conscience that they do have an element of guilt, but it's not enough to keep to overcome the addiction. And I think that's the thing that we really maybe have failed to acknowledge, is that it really isn't just a bad habit. It really has a number of the characteristics of a true addiction.
That is an excellent point, and I hope our listeners catch what you just said, because I want to go back and make sure they do. There are those. It's still, you know, there's a little bit of shame associated with it, as we would argue that there should be, because it's wrong. However, people think that, oh, I can just kick this, but this is, as you talked about, it's an addictive behavior. This stuff is so addictive, drawing people in, that just saying I'm going to quit is not enough. And so people need to seek help. This is where we need churches, we need counselors, we need others to be available, and people feel free to go and get the help that's needed. And I think that's a part of what this public awareness campaign is all about.
Absolutely. It is an effort, as has happened in other areas that are harmful to society, to say you need to come and get help. Don't just keep dealing with this problem, because there are a lot of people out there, I think, who realize they have a problem, they realize it's impacting their professional life, their family life, The National Center on Sexual Exploitation has issued a paper not too long ago that had some 80 studies in it that confirmed that everything from just the impact that this has on youth and the young age at which children are first impacted, to the actual effects on the brain that are so similar to a drug addiction in terms of what happens to your minds when this happens. And the damage is to society has already been significant. The problem is that we continue to ignore it, and we continue to act like, well, this will just work itself out, and it's not. And I do believe that it is largely the solution is largely from the pulpit rather than from the dais. But there are things that we can do as public officials to bring an awareness and to try to draw people into exactly the mindset that you're describing, where they say, I have a problem and I need to seek help in solving this problem.
Well, Senator Emery, I thank you for taking this on and providing this spotlight on a problem that is a significant problem that affects not just individuals, but all of society. So thanks for doing that, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for all that you do, and it was a pleasure.
All right. Senator Ed Emery from Missouri. By the way, you know, this is something we've talked about with Josh McDowell. He did a massive study on this to show how problematic this issue was. And I said I wasn't going to announce it again because I think we're full, but Josh McDowell is going to be at our pastor's briefing next week. All right, don't go away. When we come back, two of FRC experts join me to talk about California's totalitarian tactics. Don't go away.
Are you a pastor? Do you know a pastor? We want to invite pastors to Family Research Council's Watchmen on the Wall Pastors Briefing on May 23rd through 25th in Washington, D.C. The theme this year is While It Is Day, Repent, Unite, Engage. Pastors will hear from John Bevere, Michelle Bachman, Josh McDowell, Kay Arthur, Todd Starnes, congressional leaders, and others who will inform, inspire, and equip them to engage on issues relevant to today's culture. They will also enjoy a tour and reception at Museum of the Bible, a spiritual heritage tour of the U.S. Capitol, and networking with other pastors from around the nation. Registration is just $249 for first-time pastors and $299 for pastors who have attended before. FRC has limited funding to cover hotels and meal costs. For more information and to register, call 1-800-225-4008 or visit watchmanpastors.org. That's 1-800-225-4008 or watchmanpastors.org.
Since the 2016 election, faith, family, and freedom are on the move in America. Can values voters keep the momentum going in November? If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand with our leaders and fight for our values. To join this noble mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st to 23rd in Washington, D.C. And join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. You'll also find plenty of networking opportunities with attendees and organizations that share a Christian worldview on issues like religious liberty, the sanctity of life, natural marriage, and national security. On September 21st to 23rd, stand with Values Voters to restore our great nation. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org. Hello, can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice.
For years, big money has flowed from big mobile carriers to liberals fighting to fund organizations like Planned Parenthood. With Patriot Mobile, a portion of your bill will be used to support conservative organizations like Family Research Council Action. And as an exclusive FRC Action offer, get a free $50 credit with a 24-month contract when you use promo code FRCA18. Call now 1-800-APATRIOT or visit patriotmobile.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. All right, a chilling trend that we see across the country, you know, it did coincide with the Obama administration and the pushing of a very liberal agenda. And it's this totalitarian tactic of essentially silencing anything you disagree with. Now, it primarily revolves around the issue of human sexuality. And we've seen this kind of go from state to state. But one of the most egregious, far-reaching, frightening pieces of legislation has surfaced in, you guessed it, California. And it is AB 2943. And I'm telling you what, this thing has pastors and parents and all kinds of people worked up finally in California because of how far-reaching it is. How far-reaching is it? Well, to help dissect this and explain what is taking place and why you should be concerned, even if you don't live in California, is Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow for Policy Studies here at the Family Research Council. Peter, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony.
And Travis Weber, who is the Director of our Center for Religious Liberty. Travis, welcome back.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, Peter, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to move to the legal side of this and the threat to religious liberty, which is why I've got Travis here. But I want to start with you with this issue of limiting speech, limiting counseling, just because it's connected to the issue of homosexuality. We've seen this before. We've seen it in New Jersey, seen it in several other states. But this is unlike anything we've seen before. Explain to our listeners.
Right. Well, a little bit of the background. This has to do with what are called sexual orientation change efforts or sexual reorientation therapy. The critics, the LGBT activists, like to call it conversion therapy, but the people who practice it don't use that term. Some people who experience same-sex attractions or who experience gender dysphoria seek help to try to make peace with their biological sex and to overcome their same-sex attractions, and sometimes seek the help of a therapist or counselor. Well, LGBT activists don't like that, and so they pioneered this in California 12 years ago, I mean in 2012, 6 years ago, by passing a law to prohibit sexual orientation change efforts by licensed mental health providers when the client is a minor. So the theory being minors are vulnerable to being coerced into doing this, and this is part of the regulation of licensed mental health providers. Well, that attack, we were strongly opposed to that at the time, but it was limited in scope. You mentioned New Jersey. In New Jersey, 3 years later, the Southern Poverty Law Center, our friends there, filed a lawsuit against Jonah.
I thought they were just about labeling hate groups or something. They're actually out there advocating against policies and advancing their own policies.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're not fighting poverty in the South, but they are
they're
fighting
impoverished. They're impoverished, only in their ethics, though. But go ahead. I digress.
They filed a lawsuit against a Jewish ex-gay ministry called Jonah in New Jersey, charging that that offering this type of service was a violation of the consumer fraud laws. And they actually had a very biased judge there who wouldn't allow the defendants to offer any of their expert witnesses. And so that resulted in a judgment against the Jonah on this theory. So now in California, move forward to...
Well, there's another in between there, because we saw this similar line of attack in Michigan, where we had a pastor, where they had a conference where they were, people who were struggling with their sexual identity could come and they received treatment.
Or at least receive some counseling.
Information. But then lawmakers actually filed a complaint with the attorney general wanting them to pursue unfair trade practices, using the same line of
attack. The same line of thought, this theory that it's consumer fraud to accept money in exchange for trying to change someone's sexual orientation. Michigan didn't have a law.
They didn't have a law, right. But the same argument, the same line of attack. I mean, this is, and let me be very clear here, so people understand what we're talking about. This is voluntary. This is people that are seeking out this help, saying, and I know you've been a pastor. You've been involved a lot with the counseling aspect. Isn't one of the primary principles of counseling is that the treatment that a person receives is an agreement, an arrangement between their counselor and themselves?
Yes, it's supposed to be the privacy of the therapist-client relationship is supposed to be sacrosanct, just like a pastor and a parishioner, or a priest and a penitent, or an attorney and a client. Those are relationships that the state is not supposed to interfere with, but they're choosing to do this in some states.
Well, that turns it on its head.
Oh, exactly.
So, California.
California this year is looking at AB 2943, which would greatly expand this restriction on sexual orientation change efforts to cover all counselors, not just licensed mental health providers, but all counselors, including religious counselors, and to cover any sort of client, whether they're an adult or a minor, not just minors, but consenting adults as well. This would be prohibited for anybody, again, on this consumer fraud theory. And because this bill is so sweeping, we see it as a serious threat to religious liberty in particular.
But it goes beyond just counseling, between, a 40-year-old mother of three who is all of a sudden dealing with sexual identity issues. She couldn't get counseling from a therapist under this law. but it also applies to bookstores. If a publication dealt with this issue, according to this law, that could be banned.
The way it's written, it could be. Yeah, I don't know if you.
So, Travis,
that,
I mean, this appears to, I mean, be a significant violation of the First Amendment.
It's an incredible violation, and as Peter pointed out, it's under the guise of consumer fraud. It's under the guise of the therapy line of approach from the activists, but the consequences, the effects of this are incredibly broad, incredibly in violation of the First Amendment, because as we've started to discuss, the bill by its definition covers individuals, associations, and quote other groups unquote. However organized, other groups means basically anyone, as long as they're connected to a sale of a good or service, which includes books, it includes a conference you may have a payment connected to, all sorts of other activities you connect a payment to. If those activities are connected to the bill's definition of its prohibition on sexual orientation change efforts, that is prohibited by this bill. So this is an attack on the traditional historic Christian position, biblical position on human sexuality. There's really no other way to put it when you look at the fact that the bill prohibits anything but an affirming and accepting of someone toward an LGBT lifestyle.
That's an important point I want to bring up. It's a one-way restriction. It's not like a prohibition against talking about the issue. It is a restriction about talking about one side of the issue.
Right, and trying to move them in a particular direction. And a couple of key phrases that are in the bill, the other side has disputed some of these charges about the limitation on freedom, but it says any good or service, and therefore that's why we say this could apply even to the sale of books,
because there's a financial transaction.
Right.
So there's got to be some, like Travis said, if you have a conference and you buy a ticket, that's a financial transaction.
If there's a financial transaction, and it also covers efforts to change behaviors, not just trying to change someone's gender identity or their sexual attractions, but even if you try to change their behaviors, in other words, if you teach them Christian moral teaching that you should not engage in this behavior, that could be construed as an effort to change their sexual orientation.
This is incredible when you think about it. And the underlying premise, as you were setting this up for the California bill and what we've seen moving across, I don't know, are we about 10, 11 states that have these prohibitions now on this type of counseling, where if someone wants help, they can't get it. But, how would this be different from other sexual issues? I mean, for instance, someone's addicted to pornography and they want help. I mean, they have a right to go to a counselor and get it, do they not?
Yes, and so this is unique. This is another thing people need to understand. This is something completely unique in the entire history of therapy or counseling. Never before has a therapy or been restricted simply because of the goal, the client-chosen goal, which it seeks to achieve. This is completely unprecedented legally, and it violates traditional ethical codes of the counseling profession, where it's supposed to be client self-determination, client autonomy. The client chooses the goals of therapy, not the therapist. And yet that, again, is being violated here.
But it's just this one area.
Only in this area.
Mm-hmm. The religious freedom aspect about this, I mean, that's long been a recognizable freedom that that both sides of the political spectrum have protected. But in recent years, over this issue of sexuality, religious freedom is being trampled.
Very much so. And it's really warped in this area. I think this is an incredibly important opportunity for Christians across the United States to understand that AB 2943 is the type of thing which affects them. If they adhere to the biblical position on sexuality, it affects them. It's not some separate issue that will not affect them. And here's the point. This bill could even be used to prevent a situation in which a man struggling with same-sex attraction goes to a counselor and says, I'm struggling with this. And the counselor says, encourages them to be celibate, remain faithful to their wife. It encourages them to adhere to the Bible's instruction on this. That could be prohibited. That's something Christians across America can agree on, Tony. It's not just some isolated issue.
And to go back to the financial transaction. Folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins, Peter Sprigg, Travis Weber. Both of our FRC policy division discussing AB 2943 in California. It's passed the Assembly, the House. It's over in the Senate. Many churches today, in fact, the church I pastored, you know, just because of the volume of work that a pastor has of a large church, they often have professional counselors that work with them. So we had a counsel that would be there 1 or 2 days a week that people would come in for where marriage counseling, other issues. This would prohibit a church-based counselor if there is a financial transaction, and most times there are. This would prohibit them from just going through what you just said, Travis, about saying what the Scripture has to say about human sexuality and the confines of that within the union of a man and a woman.
Yeah, a church would be an other group at a minimum under this law.
Because there's no exemption.
There's no exemption. It would be an other group.
And by the way, we're not for religious exemption because religious exemption is not to an institution. It is a universal provision that we as Americans have.
Yeah, so we're arguing for religious freedom, and this bill is an incredible encroachment on religious freedom and the ability to freely live out one's beliefs. You know, you just mentioned churches. If a church is engaged in some sort of connection of monetary sale related to any of these provisions, it would be off limits. Look, even the British government recently tabled one of these measures because it said this could have unintended consequences. And the British government is no robust promoter of free speech.
Well, they don't have a First Amendment.
They don't, but they're still recognizing this principle. If they're recognizing this principle, people in California need to recognize it and across the United States.
I mean, Peter, I mean, how are parents going to deal with this when you know, parents want to try to help their children who are struggling with something? They can't even put the facts in front of the children, because we've seen, you've talked about the studies that show that many of these adolescents that are struggling, and we're talking about adolescents here, but this covers everybody,
right,
those who are having issues with sexual identity in most cases grow out of it.
Well, yes, and I'm working on another paper right now, but I've cited this before, the Adolescent Health Study, which is one of the most comprehensive studies done on this subject. They've asked questions about sexual orientation and found that a significant at one point, boys were asked, and those what their sexual orientation was. Those who described themselves as exclusively homosexual, just 1 year later, only 11% still describe themselves as exclusively homosexual. We know, and even liberal researchers know, that sexual identity and sexual attractions are very fluid, especially in adolescence. Mm-hmm. And yet they're perpetuating this myth that people are born gay and can never change. Now, you mentioned parents. Of course, we think parents have the right to control the health care for their children. This is a direct and deliberate attack upon parental rights. The sponsors have even said that. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, most of these therapists will only work with people who are voluntarily seeking this.
Peter, thank you. We got to go. We're up against a break. But Travis, one final question on this. What is the LGBT community afraid of that they won't allow the facts to be put out there?
Well, I think, you know, this is an underlying worldview clash, a cultural clash. And when you want to engage in certain practices, you have to stifle anything, any worldview which comes against certain practices. And I think that's what's underlying this.
Peter, Travis, thank you so much for joining us. Folks, to find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you live in California, spread the word of AB 2943. And if you don't live there, realize this could be coming to a legislature near you. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.